Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week, we talked about artists coming to New York, as they've done for generations, and then deciding to leave New York. Now, this has become a theme in the current mayoral race here in the city, and musicians and writers and observers of the scene have weighed in on how the city is more welcoming to the rich than to the artistic. But our listener Charles called in to remind us that this is not a new phenomenon.
Edmund Wilson, the scholar from the 20s, who was in love with Edna St. Vincent Millay, 2 years after they had their little thing in 1920, he went to Paris to see her. And he said to her, you know, New York is changing. Money is the thing to get, not wine, not love. And that was 1922. So this is a gold rush town. It's sad.
Thanks, Charles, and thanks to everyone who called and commented. Now, that segment last week had a New York focus, but it's a universal thing. Artists go where the arts are, and the support for the arts. The hugely popular pianist Valentina Lisitsa came from Ukraine and moved to, not New York, North Carolina. Still, she went where the art is, onto YouTube, which launched her global career. She'll play live for us. Speaking of YouTube, I found this clip of comedian and filmmaker Woody Allen there. Sorry, I meant comedian, filmmaker, and clarinetist. Yes, Woody Allen studied and still plays the clarinet. A lot of powerful and successful people say music is directly related to their professional achievements. There's the billionaire tech mogul who also plays guitar, a White House correspondent with a talent for French horn, and a Federal Reserve chairman with a past life as a jazz musician. Joanne Lippman spoke to all of them for her New York Times piece, Is Music the Key to Success? Lippman is a former editor at the Wall Street Journal and Condé Nast Portfolio and co-author of a new book called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. Joanne, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So what possessed you to start down the road of talking with all these big-name folks about music?
So in writing Strings Attached tells the story of this inspirational music teacher
right.
who changed the lives of thousands of students. And he was a public school music teacher. He was my own music teacher as a kid. And while we were reporting this story, I kept running across really high-profile, successful people who had these kind of secret stealth lives as musicians and serious music training.
Some of whom are, I mean, Woody Allen. You spoke to Woody Allen,
yes.
The filmmaker, the writer, comedian. It's pretty well known that he's a jazz clarinetist and he'll sit in on sessions and jazz clubs on the West Side, et cetera, et cetera. Who else did you speak to?
So Woody Allen is one that we all knew, and it was great to be able to talk with him about kind of his passion for music. Where does that come from, and mm-hmm. how does that relate to his professional success? And but there were all these others. So Alan Greenspan, now I come, you know, my Wall Street Journal background, mm-hmm. I'd heard that he played the clarinet. You know, Alan Greenspan played clarinet and sax, went to Juilliard, played professionally.
Really?
And he'd played along, among others, as a teenager, he had played alongside Stan Getz.
Wow. So he was not just a clarinetist. He must have been pretty good.
He was really good. But the funny thing, what Alan Greenspan said to me was that as good as he was as an amateur, he was distinctly, what did he call himself, average as a professional. And you know what? One of the things he talked about, the question I asked him and the question I asked all of these people, Paul Allen, the founder of Microsoft, and Woody Allen, and James Wolfensohn, who runs the World Bank and was president of the World Bank and plays the cello.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I asked all of them is, what is the connection, or even is there a connection? And one of the things that Alan Greenspan said was, he said, as a statistician, I can tell you it is not a coincidence.
Mm. So Alan Greenspan, as a teenager, plays the clarinet, plays the sax. He's good enough to play with Stan Getz. He grows up influenced by music like this. Benny Goodman sextet in the 1939 recording of Rose Room, something that a young Alan Greenspan told my guest, Joanne Lippman, that was very important to him. You said he told you that as a statistician, it is no coincidence that all these successful people in other genres, other areas of endeavor, have music in their background.
That's exactly right. And he was influenced, as he told me, by Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw.
Was he able to say how?
You know, he talked about a few different things, as did the other people I spoke to. One of the things that he spoke to and many others did was just kind of this idea of expressing yourself. It's a different mode of expression. Alan Greenspan did talk about the connection between mathematics and music, which is something that has been established.
Right.
And he noted that it seemed like the people with the highly mathematical minds really did seem to gravitate toward both classical music and high-level jazz by, you know, people like his icons, like like Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw. But I think there's more to it than that. And some of the other people I spoke with talked, for example, Paul Allen, who was a co-founder of Microsoft, billionaire philanthropist, sports team owner, talked a lot about how music is like the flip side of kind of the programming analytical brain. And that he felt that it really opened up pathways to creativity.
Now, and tellingly, he was not listening to classical music or classic jazz, but rather to... Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child. So Paul Allen, before co-founding Microsoft, before going on to own professional sports teams, this was him getting his jam on.
This was Paul Allen's inspiration. And Paul Allen told me that he actually had started out as a violin player at the age of 7. He came from a family that really appreciated great music. But that as when he was about 14, 15 years old, a family friend introduced him to Jimi Hendrix and the guitar, and he became a very serious guitar player. And he said, actually, in high school, there was a moment where he could have, you know, two paths spread out before him. He could have gone on to become, as he said, a moderately okay guitar player, or he could have gone into computer programming. And as he said, that came out pretty darn well.
That was more than a moderate success, yeah. We're speaking with Joanne Lippman. She has written this book called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations, which we can talk about in a bit. But she's also written an article for the New York Times recently called Is Music the Key to Success? And one thing that's already struck me is Woody Allen, Alan Greenspan, and Paul Allen now have all told you essentially the same thing, which was they were really into music, but they were not great at it.
Yes.
You know, the fact that even Alan Greenspan, who played with Stan Getz as a teenager, said he was great as an amateur, but only like mediocre as a professional. So it doesn't mean you have to be great at music, just that there's something to what? The discipline of practicing and stuff like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. First of all, there's the passion for the music itself. And I think that what all of the people I spoke with have in common is a passion, deep passion for whatever it is that they're doing. And I think that started for many of them with music. And one other thing that they spoke about, a lot of them spoke about, because all the people I spoke with had very serious music training. And you talk to these very successful people, and they will tell you about the focus and the discipline. So for example, Chuck Todd, who was the NBC White House correspondent, was a very serious French horn player. He went to college on a French horn scholarship. And he talked a lot about kind of the hard work, focused discipline that he brings to his work is something he learned from the French horn.
And with the French horn, with instruments like that, you can't just like put that in a closet and take it out after a couple of years because you lose your lip.
That's right. You do lose your lip. And
The embouchure is
the embouchure. And actually, I had a whole bunch of people talking to me. Woody Allen had a long discussion with me about his embouchure, and that's why he practices every single day.
Right. So, if you do love it, you have to keep it up. It sort of forces you to keep it. It's like, with the guitar, if I don't play the guitar too long, I start to lose the calluses on my fingers, and it's a pain in the neck to get them back. So,
sure,
you have to pick it up occasionally and just keep your hand in, literally. There are lots of people who are passionate about music. What seems to separate these folks that you've been talking about who've been so successful in other fields is their passion is a participatory one. They actually go through the process of practicing and playing and being kind of inside the act of making music.
That's exactly right. So it was with Strings Attached, as we were writing Strings Attached, what actually sparked this whole thing is because Strings Attached, as I said, tells the story of this incredibly successful but unheralded school music teacher. And what sparked my quest in talking to all of these people was that I noticed that his own students had gone on to such outsized success. Mm. And it got me wondering about what is that connection?
All right. We're speaking with Joanne Lippman about this idea of music being the key to success in other fields. And Steve Hayden, the ad executive, yet another person that you spoke to. What's his story?
Steve Hayden had the most amazing story. So he is famous in advertising circles for creating what may be the most famous commercial ever, which is the Apple 1984 commercial, which shows a kind of overthrow of a dictator, the gray masses, with a runner comes through and is with a hammer and smashes a screen with a dictator's face on it. And it was really breakthrough. And Steve, as it turns out, was a very serious cellist who actually attended Interlochen, which is a boarding school and art school.
In Michigan.
And he was a high school student. Like, he was a serious musician. Mm-hmm. And he told me that the 1984 commercial was inspired by Stravinsky.
Excerpt, of course, from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. So, Joanne, this is what Steve Hayden was listening to. This was the inspiration for that famous commercial.
That's
that
right.
Apple
so,
commercial.
First of all, I love Stravinsky. I could listen to that. I love that. And what Steve Hayden said to me was that it's all about rebellion, and that particularly as he was growing up in his household, it signified a complete rebellion against what we thought of as classical music, and that was what animated him. And you can hear it when you listen to that music. You can imagine what was going through his brain that helped kind of open the creative juices to think about rebellion.
And that the tagline of that famous commercial, you know, because of Apple, 1984 won't be like 1984.
That's right.
He was pretty, I mean, yeah, that's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
That's getting on 30 years, you know?
It was revolutionary. It really changed the way advertising, the way people think about advertising.
Now, Joanne, is there a danger in all of these stories about how music has helped people succeed in business and the art, you know, other arts and in other other occupations, where we begin to think of music as just sort of a utilitarian thing, you know, a tool to help you succeed in what really matters, math and business and stuff like that.
Right. I of course, argue that music in and of itself is the end as opposed to a tool to get you somewhere else. And I think that probably everyone I talk to would argue the same thing. I mean, when I spoke with Woody Allen, he really articulated so well just the joy of playing. And unlike the others I spoke with who could really make a direct connection with their work, Woody Allen said, for me, it's not a direct connection. In fact, it's totally separate. It is my way of disconnecting and really just, you know, he loves the music. He loves all kinds of music. But particularly New Orleans jazz, which is right. What he plays.
So that for him is a kind of respite from his day job as a writer-director.
Which is so interesting because of all the people that I spoke with, Woody Allen is the one whose music most infuses his day job. If you listen to the soundtracks of any of his films,
yeah.
They're all, you know, the music is fantastic, and especially jazz infuses all of his soundtracks.
All right. The article is in the New York Times, came out on October 12th, called Is Music the Key to Success by Joanne Lipman. But she's also co-author of the book that she mentioned as sort of the initiator of this whole article and all the questions attached to it. And that book, called Strings Attached, is something that we're going to talk about in just a moment, all about, you know, the gift of a great teacher, of a tough teacher. And Soundcheck listeners, did you have a formative musical experience or one of those teachers that you've never forgotten or a musical background that helped you succeed in something else? We want to hear your story. You can post a comment on our page at soundcheck.org or leave your story on our listener hotline, 866-939-1612, and we might just use it on an upcoming show. That's 866-939-1612. In the background, the Ukrainian-born American pianist Valentina Lisitsa will be joining us later, and we'll find out what her formative musical experience was before she became famous via YouTube. That's coming up later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we're speaking with Joanne Lipman, former deputy managing editor of The Wall Street Journal and founding editor-in-chief of Condé Nast Portfolio and co-author of the new book, Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. And once again, we're inviting you to share your story of a formative music experience, an important music teacher early in your life. You can leave a comment at soundcheck.org or leave your story on our voicemail, 866-939-1612. So, Joanne, you told us how the act of writing this book sent you on the path of speaking to all these highly successful people about their own musical experiences as a kid. What about yours?
So, Strings Attached tells the story of a man named Jerry Kubchinski, who we all knew as Mr. K, who was essentially the toughest teacher anyone ever had. I mean, we thought he was the toughest teacher in the world. He was our music teacher. He was our orchestra conductor. And what was interesting about him is, so I was, you know, he was about the toughest guy I'd ever had. I grew up and left music. I went into journalism. I spent many years at the Wall Street Journal, at Condé Nast. What happened was that here's a guy I'd lost touch with. Uh-huh. And when I heard that he had passed away many years later, it suddenly strikes me, you know what? This is a guy who made all the difference in my life. And I realized that I was using kind of what he taught me, not just in music, but just sort of the things like resilience and motivation and all those sorts of things every day. And I felt compelled to go back to his memorial service, which was going to be a little concert by mm-hmm. alums. And I felt compelled to bring back my old viola, which I no longer played. But I said, I have to be there because this man changed my life. And when I walked in for this little memorial service, thinking I was kind of nuts that it was just me, and I walk in and I see 40 years worth of students have returned, have flown in from all over the country with their old instruments in tow, because they felt exactly as I did, that this one music teacher changed all of our lives.
And as the subtitle of the book says, a tough teacher. I mean, as you said just a moment ago, the toughest teacher any of you had ever had, which, you know, that's the kind of person that as a kid, when you're in the middle of the practice and, you know, the experience of being with this person, you probably hate.
Well, you certainly don't appreciate him at the time. But, you know, over time, you sort of realize that this is the guy who's looking out for you. And I think it's because he held us to a higher standard. And, you know, he was tougher on us than our other teachers, than our parents. But what he did for us was that he made us better than really we had any right to be. Mm-hmm. You know, his highest praise, he didn't praise us. He didn't have any of that kind of false, you're so great. I never even heard him use the word talent. But what you did get commended for was hard work. Mm-hmm. So his highest praise was not bad. And if you got a not bad, you were dancing down the street. You were so happy. And you would go home and you would practice twice as long.
Now, you co-wrote this book with Mr. Kupczynski's daughter, Melanie.
That's right.
Who was presumably also a student of his.
So Melanie and I are the same age. We grew up together. Melanie was a child prodigy violinist. I was kind of an ordinary student who started as a 10-year-old. And Mr. K, our teacher, put us together into a string quartet. So we ended up performing as a string quartet as children for many years with Melanie and her sister and another friend. Kind of touring up and down the East Coast and playing. And Melanie
touring
and I,
like other schools? Other, or?
You know, yeah. Schools, colleges, yeah. That sort of thing. Oh. Melanie went on to become a wonderful violinist who she's been with the Chicago Symphony now for more than 20 years.
Wow.
We had gone our separate ways. But we had actually lost touch. And so one of the amazing things about Strings Attached is we had kind of reconnected at this memorial service for Mr. K. And I'd written about kind of this mentor for the New York Times, the idea of this tough teacher who you don't appreciate, you don't realize how much you love him until he's gone. And it had gotten this huge viral response from people saying, you know, this reminds me of my soccer coach or
right.
my English professor, because
right.
you realize that just about everybody has someone like that in their past who has changed their life. And that was when we realized that his was a story that just deserved to be told.
And it is told in the book called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations by my guest Joanne Lippman and Mr. K's daughter, Melanie Kupczynski. Now, we actually have a recording of the two of you as part of your string quartet that Mr. K put together. This is a 1975 live performance at Philadelphia. Do you remember this? It was the National Convention of Music Teachers.
I do remember this, yeah.
Okay, well, let's listen in. This is Joanne Lippman with Melanie Kupczynski and two other members of the string quartet playing some of Haydn's Lark Quartet. Thank you. little bit of Haydn's Lark Quartet in a live performance in Philadelphia at the National Convention of Music Teachers in 1975. Miriam Simon on cello, Stephanie Kupczynski on violin, Melanie Kupczynski on violin, and playing the viola, my guest Joanne Littman. How old were you all back then?
I think we were maybe 9 and 11 and 12, maybe, okay. Something like that. I loved hearing that. That just makes me laugh. But this is a testament to Mr. K, the teacher, and it is a testament to a great teacher, because that little quartet that you heard, Melanie, my co-author, was a child prodigy and a fantastic violinist. I had been playing the viola, I think, maybe 2 years or less at that point. And it just shows you what a great teacher can do to put together a group like that.
And even if it's not, you know, perfect pitch, you know, even if the intonation isn't spot on for every note, you're out there as a kid learning to present yourself in public. To kind of push through when things are not perfect. I mean, those are skills. Those are coping skills that a lot of people never learn.
Those are coping skills that last a lifetime. And actually, everything that went into that performance, into everything that we did with Mr. K, actually are skills that do last a lifetime. I mean, one of the things that he did do with us was he put us out there. We had to audition all the time for various orchestras and placements. And he had us performing like this all the time, you know, and we had to live up to that. And the interesting thing is he never focused on whether we failed or succeeded in an audition. It was always about kind of, you know, how will you improve next time? And his favorite expression, and he had this big Ukrainian accent, was discipline yourself. And I found that so interesting in retrospect, because it wasn't listen to me. It wasn't do what I say. It was discipline yourself, which really transferred kind of the responsibility to the student and really made us much more self-motivated.
And this is probably an experience that many of our listeners have shared. So listeners, if you had that special music teacher or that formative musical experience, we want to hear about it. Post your comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave your story at our voicemail, our listener line, 866-939-1612. And maybe we'll use that on an upcoming show, 866-939-1612. Some of Mr. K's teaching methods would appear unorthodox today and possibly not even allowed by some parents, right?
That is absolutely true. That is very true. I mean, this is a guy who, he had a huge heart, but this is also the guy who, during a rehearsal, if somebody played a wrong note, he would stop the entire orchestra and he would say, "Who is idiot who played wrong note?" So, yeah, I would not advocate that. I think that would be tough to get away with nowadays. But I do think that there are a lot of other methods that he had that really, really were highly successful. I mean, the fact that he didn't give us praise if we didn't deserve it actually was really useful. The fact that he let us fail, that we had to audition, and that sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And he didn't, as I said, he didn't dwell on that. But what it did, and one of his students really articulated this very well, one of his students said to me, he taught us how to fail and how to pick ourselves up again. And I think that's such an important life skill. It's resilience.
Right. The book is Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. Raises many questions, listeners, so let us hear from you. Your experience, what you think of, you know, a tough teacher versus the catch them being good variety that we hear now. You can leave your story on our website, soundcheck.org, or call us at 866-939-1612. Joanne Littman is co-author of Strings Attached, along with Mr. K's daughter, Melanie Kupczynski. Joanne, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Last week on the show, we talked about the idea of packing it in and leaving New York, a decision that a lot of artists and creatives have struggled with, especially in the past few decades, as New York's crime rate has dropped and the city has gotten increasingly expensive. We asked you to share your experiences, and predictably, we heard mostly from people here in the New York area, like our listener Penelope.
I have been a struggling artist for a while, I don't know if I want to stay here. It just feels more and more constrained and restricted. And there are tiny little pockets in Manhattan that I think still are very vibrant and emerging and then collapsing, but it's gone so quickly.
Lots of comments on our webpage, too. That girl from Manhattan writes, "Oh, please, yet another person who spent a few months post-undergrad who had to leave. Most of us see the prospect of staying in New York as a metaphor for surviving and thriving." As Mick Jagger once warbled on the subject, you can call us up anytime. Our number is 866-939-1612. Up next, live music in our studio from a pianist whose videos have been viewed tens of millions of times on YouTube. Valentina Lisitsa plays Liszt live in our studio. And we'll check in with some of the Soundcheck staff about their favorite new releases from this past week. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We've been talking about how an early music education can give you the discipline and determination to succeed in other fields, especially when you have that one special teacher like Joanne Lippmann had. Well, this pianist, Valentina Lisitsa, has succeeded in the music field, but she's done it in a slightly different way. See, someone illegally uploaded a YouTube video of her playing Chopin back in 2007, but Valentina, showing that discipline and determination we were talking about earlier, fought back by putting everything on YouTube. That's when success came. 1 million views, then 10 million, then 30 million. Now she's got a major record company deal and a global career that included opening night of the 92nd Street Y season here in New York this past weekend. Her new album is This Music by Franz Liszt, and Valentina is going to start us off today with Liszt's arrangement of Franz Schubert's Erlkönig. It's Valentina Lisitsa live on Soundcheck. Thank you. That is Valentina Lisitsa live on soundcheck at our piano, playing Franz Liszt's arrangement of Franz Schubert's song Erlkönig. Valentina, very nice to have you with us on soundcheck.
Delighted to be here.
You know, we were talking earlier today with Joanne Lippmann about her book about that one music teacher and how that person had such an impact on her life. Mm-hmm. Did you have a teacher?
Oh, gosh. When people ask me whom did they study with, I tell with dead people.
With dead people.
Yes, it's perfect Halloween team. But in a way, it's true because I studied with old recordings, with people whom I possibly cannot study. I name as my teachers Rachmaninoff, Hoffman, Backhaus.
So some of the great old
pianists.
Yes,
great old golden age.
Yeah, school. 1920s and 30s
yes.
recordings.
Yeah.
So are you self-taught mostly?
I was contrarian in everything. Yes, I had normal teacher, and I did everything opposite. Mm. Since I was a little child, I would do, you know, if my teacher would tell me to hold my elbows close to my body, I would stick them out, and vice versa, and so on.
Well, I'm happy that we are shooting video today, because it was fun watching you play Erlkönig there.
Fun?
Fun for me. For me, it was watching your hands move impossibly fast up and down the keyboard.
All that coffee.
But then that's what Franz Liszt was all about. I mean, people talk about you using YouTube and the 30 million views to kind of launch your career. But wasn't Franz Liszt doing the same thing back in the 19th? I mean, not YouTube.
Well, yes, YouTube of his time. First of all, the correction. It's like 64 million or something.
64
yes,
million.
Yes, it's not 30, but
okay,
who counts?
So another 30 million since this
things.
Morning
yeah.
when I last
but
checked.
You're so right. You know, classical music, it constantly, you know, it spreads around. And every time with every generation, we scream that we're cheapening the experience because we're catering to masses. And Liszt picked up classical music when it was still salon experience for privileged few, for mm-hmm. elite, for educated. He took it to big concert halls. He was the one who invented solo recital.
Right.
And there was no way back. And yet he expanded the audience for classical music. People were excited to come and listen to it. And that's, you know, that's how we end up in the epoch of YouTube.
And the ladies liked to see Franz Liszt. He had those dark, brooding, good looks. And, you know, so he was kind of a pop star.
Yes,
as
yeah.
well as a classical musician.
One of my favorite movies, Listomania by Ken
Listomania.
Russell. Oh, yes. Yeah. Not for under 18, please.
Yeah. So why were you taken by surprise by your initial success on YouTube?
Not at all. You know, it's very easy to see it looking backwards. I never registered a breakthrough.
So there was no one moment. It was
no.
just like a gradual...
The moment, one of moments was exactly when I put my own recording.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, when I was just giving up and saying, okay, it's for free, you know, forget it, I quit. I'm not recording label. And the next day we woke up and it was number one on Amazon.
You know, number one on Amazon,
by,
yeah.
by itself, yeah. it's not a big deal, but it was ahead of Baby Einstein video,
uh-huh.
which was a big deal.
So you were number one, Baby Einstein was number two.
Yes, how sweet.
Nicely done. Were you close to giving up on a career in music?
Yes, of course, yeah.
yeah.
I was facing the same dilemma as everybody else.
Well, now, you know, this is another thing we were talking about earlier with Joanne Lippmann is, you know, she spoke to Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, and Woody Allen, the filmmaker, and all these people who had to make a choice at some point to give up music and go be successful in something mm-hmm. else. And they were successful, and they say that their music training mm-hmm. was part of the reason for their success.
Yes.
So if you had given up on music, what would you have done?
I don't know. Maybe I would be successful in something, you know, in marketing when I had no concerts to do. I was selling mixers on eBay quite successfully, you know. I was
selling mixers?
Yes. I was about to go actually to Sunbeam Company and tell them how terrible they are with their marketing. Because, you know, I could buy them retail and sell them for twice as much money just by providing wonderful customer service experience. But, you know, coming from ex-Soviet Union, it's right. invaluable experience.
So you are from Ukraine originally, living now sort of between North Carolina and Paris
and all kinds of airports.
Yeah, airports, yeah. Well, we are very happy you're here with us in our New York studio today. You want to play another piece for us?
Sure. What would you like?
Let's hear Liszt's La Campanella. This is a concert favorite, a sort of an encore favorite, in fact. a fiery piece by Franz Liszt. Once again, Valentina Lisitsa, live on Soundcheck. That is La Campanella by Franz Liszt, played live here in the Soundcheck studio on our piano by Valentina Lisitsa. Her new album is called Lisitsa Plays Liszt. And so did you program the album yourself? Because I know sometimes you let your listeners, your YouTube fans, program your concerts, right?
Yes, but if I would let fans program Liszt, I would end up with pieces everybody knows and plays. Yeah. But the idea was to find pieces less familiar. Mm-hmm.
So why do you let other people decide? Is it important for people to sort of feel an ownership of what you do?
Well, you know, people go to the restaurant and they choose what they want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Why not to do the same in music? And the results, you know, they're all, every time they're different and not what people expect.
Oh, good.
You never know.
All right. So you've got the, you know, there's always going to be some Chopin etudes or nocturnes, but you occasionally get a little Shostakovich
yes.
sent your way. That's nice. Valentina, it has been very nice having you here with us in the studio today. Thank you so much for playing for us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Every week brings a new batch of releases before you've even had a chance to catch up with the last ones. It is more than one person can keep up with. Fortunately, here at Soundcheck, we're more than one person. So we're often listening to different things and then kind of updating the rest of the crew. Now, in the past, we've done that in the office. But we thought, what the heck, let's do it on the air and give you a chance to hear some of what we've been listening to. So, Soundcheck producers Mike Katziff and Katie Bishop are with me now. And, Mike, let's start with you.
Sure. So, I don't know if you remember, but back this spring, we had this band from Brooklyn called Lucius.
Couldn't forget him.
Yeah. So, utterly delightful. It's fronted by two singers, Jess Wolf and Holly Lasik.
Who dress alike.
They dress alike, and the guys
style
behind
their hair
them.
The same.
Yeah. And like the guys like wear like matching suits, and they wear matching outfits and hairstyles and all this stuff. So when they came, they only had an EP, and so we'd only mm-hmm. heard a couple songs. Finally, they have a full record. It's called Wilda Woman. And
like Wildebeest.
Like Wildebeest. And it's delightful. I don't know how else to describe it, but it's like one of the most like instantly joyful records I think I've heard this year.
So give us a track that we should hear.
Sure. So let's listen to the track Hey Doreen, which is one of the singles off the record.
The band is Lucius. So that's Lucius, and the song's called Hey Doreen.
Hey Doreen.
I gotta say, I love the percussion sound.
It sounds so great. When you see them on stage, they all kind of play guitars and synths and stuff like that, but everybody in the band at one point or another plays drums, and they're all kind of banging along, and it's so infectious. And
they sound like they're banging on trash cans
yeah.
there. It's a really cool
it's
sound.
It's amazing, yeah.
All right, so that's what's been on rotation at Mike's desk. Katie, what about you?
You know, I thought that I was going to come to this table and talk about the Avett Brothers' new record, The Magpie and the Dandelion. I really like that band a lot. I just didn't find that album that interesting, and maybe I need to listen a little bit more. I liked it. It wasn't a bad album, but it just didn't catch my attention like the Dismemberment Plan's new album did. Their new album, Uncanny Valley, I actually had never even heard of this band before. They kind of broke up 10 years ago, got back together. They're a DC band that formed 20 years ago and were together for a while and then sort of called it quits in 2003. They've got this new record out, and I just think it's really sonically interesting. It kept my attention sort of all the way through. And this one track in particular called Waiting, it starts out one way, and I'll let you hear it, and then it quickly changes directions, and it just is a really, really fun listen.
All right, from the Dismemberment Plan's new record.
Said to come to this bar this night, alright. Well, you know it's my spot. Never mind, I'm sure that you forgot. Do you even know my name? I bet we all do look the same. I'm the one that you kept waiting, kept speculating, kept anticipating. While I was keeping faith, you kept calculating, so frustrating. Like a clock that ticks and ticks, but never moves and never grooves. Ain't got the time for waiting.
So, the Dismemberment Plan.
How fun is that?
A little fake out at the beginning.
Total fake out.
I love that turn.
Oh, it just really makes you want to dance. Kind of like the Lucius record. You know, I could just imagine like throwing my arms around my girlfriends and like shouting to the Lucius song. With this one, it reminds me of, it's almost like an echo of Graceland a little bit.
It's kind of a buoyant bounce.
Yeah,
to, like, the
it's
whole
like
thing.
Very bouncy. I really think it's fun.
All right, well, that's what, some of what we've been listening to in the Soundcheck office this week. My Cats of Katie Bishop with me. Lucius from Brooklyn, the Dismemberment Plan from D.C. I've been listening to, Annette, like you, Katie, I thought when I saw the list, oh, new records from Gary Newman,
right,
who I, you know, lost track of years ago, although I know he's continued to make records. And like you, I thought, oh, maybe I'll listen to that. And it was like, okay.
Yeah.
And then I heard this Tim Hecker record. Who is a guy based in Montreal. He's done a collaborative record with Daniel Lopatin, who records his 10 Tricks Point Never here in New York. And this is, it's a very unsettling kind of post-apocalyptic musical soundscape. You know his stuff.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I've followed him for a couple records now. And every time I hear it, I just have to like pick it apart and go, how did he make that?
Basically? Right. And normally he does make all the sounds himself, but on this new record called Virgins, he's actually playing with like real musicians, although it's still, the texture is still impossible to kind of, you know, unwind who's doing what. Anyway, this is not, Katie, you will not be grabbing your girlfriends and dancing along to this.
That's
I can pretty much guarantee that.
We'll flip one out.
This is from Tim Hecker from Montreal. And an excerpt from a song called Live Room. Put your hands in the air like you just don't care.
I'm crying right now. I'm hiding under my covers and crying.
I still have to say that still sounds very beautiful. As eerie as it is, it's so gorgeous.
Yeah. Live Room is the name of it from the new album by Tim Hecker. That Montreal music scene, man, there's way more than Arcade Fire going on up there. So Tim Hecker with some live musicians for a change on this new record called Virgins. So there's three of us from the Soundcheck office here listening to new releases, and none of us got to the Pearl Jam record? How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I like the Pearl Jam record okay. I thought Colts put out a great record this week as well, so there's plenty of good stuff. Like right. Every week just brings more and more stuff.
All right, so we'll have to keep doing this then. But that's a little look into what we've been listening to this week from this current batch of new releases in the Soundcheck office. Mike, Katie, thank you both.
Thanks.
Tomorrow on the show, the musical Fiddler on the Roof turns 50 next year, but its history predates that by a long stretch. We'll talk with the author of a new book called Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof. Plus, Thomas Dolby, the offbeat genius behind the 80s hit She Blinded Me with Science, joins us here in the studio with an unusual new project. And live music from the Meat Puppets, recorded at Brooklyn Bowl. That's going to do it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.